Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Mirabai Starr. She's the author of Caravan of No Despair, a memoir of loss and transformation. A little bit about Mirabai. She was in... can we just edit
start
this up?
A little bit about... Yeah.
Okay. A little bit about Mirabai Starr. She was a professor of philosophy and world religions at the University of New Mexico for 20 years. She is best known for her acclaimed translations of Dark Night of the Soul and The Interior Castle, as well as God of Love. She currently is an inspirational author and speaker who leads retreats internationally on the mystics and contemplative life. Once again, please welcome Mirabai Starr to Common Threads. Hello, Mirabai.
Hi, Fred.
We had a fascinating conversation last week, and to just bring people up to speed who may not have been with us last week, the book we're talking about today, Caravan of No Despair, is a memoir of loss. You lost a child. You lost a little brother. You've lost family. Beyond death, you've had challenges in your life, but you seem to have come out quite well. And much of this has to do with the deep spirituality that you've practiced over the years. And you were in a community. You were in communities in the Southwest. Gathering from the book, you really seem to have been a part of something really magical at a time that no longer exists. This is because we're going back like 30, 40 years ago. Tell us about being in the Southwest, being in a spiritual environment, along with those elements that weren't really that spiritual, but people were still trying. does that make sense?
Sure, it does. Well, you know, I consider myself to be dedicated to what's called the interspiritual movement. It's interesting, in my bio you said inspirational, and it's actually interspiritual, but I hope it's also inspiring to people. And the interspiritual movement is really about connecting with the heart of the world's great religions and wisdom traditions and finding that universal, perennial truth that resounds through all of them, and that truth having to do with love and compassion, mostly, and interconnectedness of all beings and all life. And I really learned that here in northern New Mexico, where I still live. You know, my family uprooted us from a stable, suburban, middle-class lifestyle in Long Island, New York, in the very early 70s, and took us on an odyssey around the U.S., and mostly living in Mexico on an isolated Caribbean beach for a year when I was 11. And we weren't going to school, obviously, so we read a lot, listened to a lot of music, made a lot of art, and ended up here in the mountains of northern New Mexico, which was a place at that time where many of the world's religious traditions were represented. There were spiritual communities forming in all of the various schools of Buddhism, Zen, Tibetan Buddhism, Theravadan Buddhism, Hinduism. There were ashrams popping up. And the Eastern traditions, but also there's a very strong Native American presence here with Taos Pueblo and all the other pueblos along the Upper Rio Grande area, and Christian mysticism, I should say, particularly the Spanish Catholic version of Christianity that's practiced here in Taos. This whole area that has been practiced for 500 years since the Spanish first came to this area and has developed a uniquely mystical quality. And so when I was a kid, you know, preteen and teenager, I was really steeped in all of these these different traditions, and they were all presented to me as being true and not in competition with one another. And so my spiritual formation really truly was an interspiritual one, and that continues to be what I teach in my own writings and talks and workshops around the world, is affirming the interconnected wisdom of all traditions. So yes, it was a particularly special time in the early 70s when all of these spiritual traditions were being explored and reclaimed, really. But it's still going on today, and it's going on in a new way. There's this sense that there's this emerging global spirituality that is an answer to our time, and that the impulse to otherize and categorize and build fences around the different religious traditions no longer makes sense. It's in this global world. My religion versus your religion is an obsolete mindset, and people are really recognizing in their own hearts, not only out in the world, but inside themselves, ourselves, we're recognizing the interconnectedness of all wisdom streams in one common ocean.
Let me ask you this. When I was talking about that particular place and that particular time, I'm gonna take an educated guess. You tell me if I'm right or wrong. The difference between when you were growing up and now, I'm going to guess that the movements are a little more mature, that people are a little more disciplined than back then. Is that correct?
Very insightful, Fred. I think you're absolutely right. And I think that there are certain traditions, particularly the Eastern traditions of Buddhism and Hinduism, and to some extent Taoism, that have taught us to cultivate that discipline that you speak of, particularly in the area of contemplative practice. You know, when you have a meditation practice and you show up for that silent sitting, no matter how you feel and what you're in the mood for and how easy or hard it is, something grows and changes inside you that does produce this kind of ripening or maturity that you're speaking of. And whereas in the time of, you know, my parents' era in the early 70s and beyond, there was a kind of free-for-all, feel-good mentality that didn't lend itself to a lot of maturity.
Mm-hmm. I'm also seeing more of a response to the call to service.
Absolutely.
To the greater community. Not just teaching meditation, but, you know, feeding the hungry and building for those who are dispossessed and all of that.
That's beautiful, Fred. Yes, you're absolutely right. And my book, God of Love, A Guide to the Heart of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, is very much built on that premise of the only thing that makes sense when we cultivate an inner life and experience directly the presence of love is to then offer the fruits of that encounter to a hungry world, and in the area of service to humanity and to animals, but also to the earth herself, who's crying out.
And I think that, you know, people can still be led by people who shouldn't be leading. That's never going to stop. And it happens in every tradition, really, that I'm aware of. However, I think that people are more circumspect today about accepting someone as a teacher, whether you want to call this teacher a lama or a guru or just a teacher. And it was easier to fall prey to people who, again, should not have been teaching. Tell us your encounter with Randy Sanders.
Not his real name, by the way. Yes, that was a perfect example of what you're speaking of Fred, there he was somebody who had a few spiritual experiences and a hunger for power and fancied himself some kind of extraordinary incarnation, and that it was his task to dispense spiritual teachings, particularly in the Sufi tradition, but it was really just whatever he felt like, a little bit of Don Juan, Carlos Castaneda, this and that. And I met him when I was 14, and he claimed to really see into my soul and recognize me as being this very high being that was like a divine, an incarnation of the Divine Mother, and that it was his task to awaken me to my true self. And that involved a secret sexual relationship. So I was 14 and he was 40. And it was this went on for throughout my teens and into my early 20s. Secretly, he was married with children my age. And he considered the secret part to be integral to the spiritual transmission. And finally, when I was in my early 20s, we pretended that now that I was grown up, we fell in love with each other, and so he left his wife, and we got married. And it took me another 10 years to be able to extricate myself from that relationship as he spiraled into mental illness and alcohol abuse. And finally, I was able to leave, and it was incredibly difficult because he had conditioned me to believe from a very young age that our relationship was that the cosmos itself really hinged on our connection, and that if I were to disengage, there would be dire consequences throughout the universe. And so, I mean, it's a kind of serious brainwashing.
I've never heard that. Wow.
Yeah. So that's why it took me so damn long. But I was very vulnerable when I met him. My first love had just died. That was my second really significant death, the death of my brother when I was 7, and the death of my first love at 14, Philip, who was killed in a gun accident. And my mother just left my father. My father was an alcoholic. My new stepfather was an alcoholic. I needed to get out of Dodge, and Randy Sanders was my rescuer, I thought. Plus, he thought I was absolutely wonderful, and everybody else was kind of ignoring my beauty and gifts. So my specialness, I'm a 4 in the Enneagram, if you're familiar with that, you know, being special is really important, was really important to me. So, yeah, I was vulnerable, did manage to leave, finally.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Caravan of No Despair, A Memoir of Loss and Transformation, is the book we're talking about today. And my guest is its author, Mirabai Starr. What's interesting in the book, I notice, is that you never call him anything but, or maybe you have, but I didn't see it, and I was actually looking for it. You never call him anything but Randy Sanders. You never call him Randy. You never call him Sanders. It's always Randy Sanders. Was that purposeful?
Absolutely. That's interesting that you noticed that little device. I don't know. It was somehow, it enabled me to distance myself a little bit, and also to not, I was also making fun of him. You know, that is definitely true. He actually had a spiritual name that he invented for himself, both a first name and a last name, the first one being Arabic and the second one being Native American. So talk about pretentious. I couldn't possibly use his real name for all kinds of reasons. Also, I didn't want to upset his children. But he's gone now. He died at the end of, as I was writing the book, the very, very end, actually.
Really?
But I didn't want to hurt them either, so there are all kinds of reasons I did that.
Looking back, just the fact that your father was an alcoholic and your stepfather was an alcoholic, and then Randy Sanders, your first husband, was an alcoholic.
What a quinky-dink,
Yeah. Was he drinking, say, during your teenage years that you were aware of? Was he exhibiting alcoholic tendencies, which you probably wouldn't even, at that age, you might not have even recognized, but I'm just curious if he was even socially drinking back then.
No, he was on a spiritual trip, as my father would call it, and he didn't start drinking until we got married.
Hmm. Let's talk about the actual loss that is perhaps the most important one in the book, the loss of a child. If you would, tell us the story of that loss, first of all.
Thank you, Fred, for asking. Well, my daughter Jenny died in a car accident when she was 14. I was 40. This was 14 years ago. And the day that Jenny was killed was the day that my first book came out, which was happened to be a translation of Dark Night of the Soul by the 16th century Spanish mystic John of the Cross, which is really a book that is grounded in the transformational power of suffering. And I never anticipated that I would be plunged into the darkest night of my own soul the very day that that book came out into the world. 14 years later, and many books later, this new one, Caravan of No Despair, my memoir, was published on the anniversary, and it was completely unplanned, on the 14th anniversary of Jenny's death. Caravan of No Despair came out. So this is the first book, really, that tells my story, where I'm really standing in my own experience. All my other books are either translations of the mystics, the Christian mystics, or commentaries and reflections on the teachings of the mystics. And this book is my own gritty, very naked story. And Jenny's death, coinciding with the release of The Dark Night of the Soul, has really set me on my path that I have been faithfully walking, whether I like it or not, ever since, really integrating the power of those perennial teachings by John of the Cross about the dark night of the soul and grief and loss.
Did you have what it might be referred to in other traditions as a crisis of faith?
Absolutely. I mean, that's when I tried to fire God. But in some ways, Fred, it was not so much an issue of my belief systems collapsing in the face of tragedy, because somehow I had learned, maybe from being so disillusioned by a charlatan teacher, lover, and also by my encounters with teachings in Buddhism and in Christian mystical traditions, where I knew not to believe everything I think. I understood already before Jenny died that it's not about belief, it's about a heart connection to the sacred, to the holy, that is personal and direct and mysterious. And so when Jenny died, it is true that none of my spiritual tricks and tools and techniques worked anymore. They all failed me, but that wasn't a problem. I was willing, I really had no choice but to let myself down into the arms of radical unknowingness, of the fire of mystery, and to just abide there. And so there was a long period where I couldn't engage in any of the spiritual practices, including contemplative practice or meditation that had sustained me all along. Nothing did. It all felt almost offensive. And certainly any kind of trite, cliche spiritual platitudes were intolerable. me, as they are for most grieving people. I'm sure many of you listening who are bereaved or have been know what I'm talking about. You just, it's really hard to bear when people try to use spiritual talk and beliefs as a, there's this great phrase I love that many of you are familiar with called spiritual bypassing. It's when we use spiritual beliefs and even practices to take us away from reality, to check us out rather than connect us to what is. And I couldn't bear anything other than authenticity during those early years.
And what brought you back? What took you out of that despair? What was on the caravan?
Well, right, and so the title of the book is Caravan of No Despair, which comes from that beautiful Rumi poem. It's actually inscribed in his tomb in Konya, Turkey. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, even if you have broken your vows a thousand times, come, come again, come. Ours is not a caravan of despair. Come again, come. And there was this sense of inclusiveness, of welcoming, that no matter what has happened to us and no matter what we have done, there is an unconditionally loving presence in this universe that enfolds and holds us. And so I think that I experienced that holding, that unconditional love, in my deepest, darkest despair. However, I do need to say that I continue to grieve the death of my daughter 14 years later. You know, as her friends are having babies and life continues, and my own child has not become a woman and is not in relationship with me in the physical form anymore, that her beautiful being was plucked like a newly blossoming flower from this world. I hate it, and I accept it. I accept that this is what is, and so my grief continues.
Your grief, but grief is not despair.
That's right, Fred. Beautifully said. Yes. In fact, it becomes, someone in a poem once, and I wish I could remember who, described grief that initially, it's a blazing fire that burns us, and it's dangerous. In fact, we burn to death in many ways. We die with our loved ones. But later, grief becomes a warm hearth that we comfort ourselves beside. And I think that has become true for me. And when you speak about service as the new mature dimension of spirituality that I think we're seeing in this globalized spiritual arena, it's, for me, service to other bereaved people has been the only thing that has made sense of my life and of Jenny's death.
We're coming down to the wire on this episode of the show, Mirabai, but briefly, if you can, if I can switch gears, because you've brought up Dark Night of the Soul and The Interior Castle a couple of different times this week and last week. These works have been translated into English before. What was the motivation for you to translate them? And certainly in a sense, in a very real sense, when somebody translates a work from another language, they make them their own. What do you think, if somebody was in the bookstore and they saw your translation of Interior Castle next to, you know, one or two others, what would you say, you know, if you had to put on your sales hat, what would you say, well, this might be why you perhaps would want mine versus the other, or vice versa?
Thank you for asking, Fred. Well, the main reason is that the existing translations of these two Spanish mystics, John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, are very hard to read. They're very dense. They're literal translations from the early Renaissance Spanish, and they're thickly theological, very, very Catholic. And my translations, although they are faithful, are not quite as literal, and they're presented in a very much more lyrical, accessible way. So people find it very easy to read my versions of Dark Night of the Soul and The Interior Castle, for instance, and they connect with people's own experience in a contemporary world much more than these more traditional translations. They also speak to people beyond the Catholic and even the Christian tradition. They have a universal quality that is informed by my universal experience with the world's great religions, and so they seem to resonate with people of any religious orientation or none.
I do recall, now that you're saying that, reading Interior Castle years ago, yeah, density is definitely an adjective to use when describing that book, at least the translation that I have, and that translation is, you know, probably 30, 40 years old, so I'm sure you're correct. Mirabai, we are out of time once again, and I appreciate your presence so much, your openness and your candidness about the experiences you've had, and I wish you the greatest success with this book.
Thank you so much, Fred, and thank you for the beautiful work you are doing in this world to bring us all together.
You're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Mirabai Starr has been our guest today. We've been speaking of her book, Caravan of No Despair, A Memoir of Loss and Transformation. Please join us again next week right here on WGVU FM.